Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
I'm Jeronimo Cortina from the University of Houston as well.
Hey, thanks for joining me, Jeronimo. We're going to talk a little politics today. A couple of really big events have happened since we've been on a hiatus. Both of them are pretty recent. We've had a couple of sets of debates for the Democrats. That's something we should definitely talk about and kind of what that picture looks like in terms of the state of play of the 2020, I shudder to say it, a presidential election. But the other is that Dennis Bonin, the Speaker of the House, is in a bit of hot water. So just for people who aren't paying much attention to this, this went very quickly from a kind of inside baseball to like what's happening under the pink dome to, hey, we're in the championship. We should pay attention to what's going on in baseball. The long and short of it is that Michael Quinn Sullivan, who is the president and CEO of Empower Texans, which is a conservative organization, went to a meeting with Speaker Bonin where apparently he had recorded what took place. Sullivan reported that essentially that Bonin suggested that he would give a press pass, which is something that the House had not done to Empower Texans in the next session, if the Empower Texans group would basically target a handful of representatives. And Bonin initially said that this was incorrect, that he had mischaracterized the nature of the race. Sullivan came back and said, surprise, I've got tapes. What is the House of Cards scenario here, Jeronimo? What is your take on kind of Bonin's now future as Speaker and what it means for the Republican Party more broadly?
Well, first of all, I have a question, right?
Okay.
Why Bonin, and apparently he was with Representative Boros as well in that meeting with Michael Quinn Sullivan, why they wanted to target these 10 Republicans? That's my first question.
Yeah.
I mean, what's for them, right? And I think I have some, you know, conspiracy theories under my...
Oh, yeah. I'll put my tinfoil hat on.
Exactly. Under my sleeve. But that's the first question. And then the second question is, the weird thing is that Speaker Bonin said, bring it on.
Yeah.
Release the entirety content of that tape.
Yeah.
So if that happens, then we'll see what's going to happen, right?
Yeah.
But apparently, you know, Empowered Texans don't like Representative Bonin in any ways or matters.
Well, and the kind of subtext of this is that Bonin basically kind of led this kumbaya, islands in the stream, Kenny Rogers, Dolly Parton session where everybody was happy and it looked like they were getting along. Now, Empowered Texans, as Speaker Bonin said many times, is never going to be satisfied. So there's obviously going to be friction. But in this case, this was like another step towards basically Bonin being set up as the enemy the same way that Joe Strauss was. So Empower Texans needs to have a villain, and Bonin is the villain. But there are a lot more villains. Like you say, there's a whole host of people who are on the list that are these kind of secret, not so secret now targets that are kind of moderate members or people who may have run afoul of Empower Texans over the years. Some of them also have run afoul Bonin. So I don't know who to believe here. I mean, at this point, we haven't heard the tape, but he says there's a tape, and other members have said that the tape exists, and it more or less kind of corroborates what Sullivan said.
Right. That was said by Representative Toth from the Woodlands, that he was shocked.
Right.
And saying that Speaker Bonin was not very truthful about the events that happened on June 12th.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the political thing here is very interesting, right? Because the issue here is the Republican Party in Texas, even though it's not like in very, 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 very hot water, you know, if we take the lessons from the last electoral cycle, the writing's on the wall.
Yeah.
And if they don't change what's going to be the discourse for the next election, they might be in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying that the state's going to be, you know, blue, 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 blue all over the place, but they're going to be very important changes that are going to start weakening the election possibilities for the Republican Party.
Yeah, and this is what Bonin and the lieutenant governor and the governor basically suggested was that we need to be unified because we are essentially fighting a war here that they're likely going to lose at some point.
Repeat those names, right? Because you have Dan Patrick, right? Yeah. The governor of Texas and Bonin.
Yeah.
That, you know, sometimes they don't see eye to eye.
Yeah.
But once they say, oops.
Yeah.
I mean, It's coming, right?
Right.
Democrats are coming. Democrats are coming.
Yeah.
It's like, we need to do something. And they did it. I mean,
yeah.
At the end of the session, the governor clearly said, you know, we have to leave this ideological thingy, you know, on hold.
Right.
Right. We need to be practical. And his state of the address was, you know, we did this, we did this. Only practical things.
Right.
So that's going to be very important.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
My question about Bonn, and assuming this is true, assuming the tape exists and it corroborates what Sullivan said, is I don't know why Empower Texans is worth the risk. I mean, they've been marginalized during the session. All of the big three said basically, like, we're going to do what we feel like we need to do. And that is connected, as you say, to the electoral changes. So Empower Texans are really essentially against the wall. But what's the worst time to, like, you know, try to grab an animal? That's when their back is to the wall, right? And that's what happened. But to me, Bonin has way better tools to be able to sanction members he doesn't like inside the chamber, right? I mean, he can sort of put them on lousy committees. Their bills won't see the light of day. He can help choke off their fundraising. Like, Bonin has got a bunch of ways to punish people he doesn't like. So using Empower as a kind of, you know, hitman for these groups, I don't see the value in it. And now he's in jeopardy, right?
In the first situation, he has to get his hand dirty, right?
Yeah.
In the other situation, he's like, oh, oops, I love you, man. I'm sorry you lost,
right,
but,
right,
you know, what do you want me to do,
hey,
right?
He was Empower, those guys. Yeah, I mean,
and you know these guys. They always do these kind of stuff.
That's
so
funny.
You know, it's a savvy political move, I think, instead
right.
of using, you know, the legislative tools that he has under his desk. But
you watch too many movies. Like,
yeah, maybe I do.
Too many House of Cards, my friend. Well, but I see your point, though. Like, basically, this is a way for him to kind of anonymously sort of, you know, have it happen without his fingerprints on it. I think that's right. But no matter how it played out, even if it wasn't true and there was no tape, the fact that there was this hint that the unity wasn't real, I think made a lot of these members sleep with one eye open, because they knew that the Republicans were not so committed to this and that there was a day where they were going to get a primary challenge and they were going to get pushed out. So I think that none of them felt safe anyway, but in general, this is not going to help. What do you think about Bonin? I mean, do you think that this is going to be the end of his speakers?
I don't think so, because, I mean, he's pretty much liked by Democrats, right? He has some sway also with moderate Republicans, right? Yeah. Although some of them are leaving, right? We hear what Representative Serwa says, like, September 30 comes.
Great point.
You know, I'm out of here. So, you know, probably, you know, the more conservative wing of the Republican Party in the state of Texas see this as an opportunity to say, you know, this is our cue. Democrats have not won, you know, enough seats to control anything like that. You need them to win now who becomes Speaker of the House. But still, it's an opening for them that they could use and run and ram someone into the speaker's position.
I think that's a great point. I mean, I think it's a 50-50 prospect that the Dems are in charge of the chamber anyway, so maybe this is all moot. But even if the Republicans do manage to hold on, all the Democrats plus the secret, targeted, non-secret Republicans now are enough to be able to choose who the Speaker of the House is. So Bonin's playing with fire. The margins aren't big enough for him to have enough cushion here to make too many people mad. So I think that could be a potential problem for him. The other problem, frankly, is just in his district. I mean, he's going to have to run for re-election. And although Empower had run people against him in the past, like, I kid you not, the guy's name, Dennis Rambo.
Right.
Did not get that close. Yeah. What a great name for a Republican candidate.
Oh, absolutely.
Dennis Rambo, the ad writes itself. But he didn't get that close to him. But I think as a prospect that maybe this is a sort of, you know, Bonin can't be trusted line that could resonate with some Republicans, even in a district where he's won.
But again,
a lot for a long
time. Look at the results of this past session, right? You have somewhat good results for the governor, good results for the lieutenant governor.
So okay, also okay results for lieutenant governor.
Okay, fine. Yeah, but he didn't push any of the legislation that he likes, right? But he was fine with it.
Yeah.
No? So the question is, are they going to get their hands dirty and push Bonin out? It's like, I don't think so.
Right, right.
Maybe I'm completely wrong, but I don't see it, right? Because Governor Abbott tried before and surprise, no, it didn't work as good as he wanted to work.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is Bonin has a lot of money.
Yeah, right.
So if someone is going to be challenged, he will have or she will have to pony up.
Yeah, it's going to be
lot of
expensive, right?
Oh, yeah. And that's going to...
You know who else has a lot of money? It are the Wilkes brothers and in all the Midland crowd, Tim Dunn and company. They got a lot of money, too.
Well,
so
that's true. That's true.
It could be the most expensive house race in the history of America for a state house seat.
Yeah, right. Well, we'll see.
We'll see
what happens.
So. Hey, well, speaking of nasty, the big story of the week and couple of weeks has been the Democratic debates. Geronimo, we had two sets of debates. I think that one takeaway was that things are getting nasty. So let's talk about the first debate first. What do you think was the kind of big takeaway from that first night's debate for people who didn't watch it? And you were not alone if you didn't watch it. The first night debate included Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, several moderates, some of whose name I do remember. Many of them probably you do remember too.
Right. I think the first thing is was, you know, the unspoken dark alliance between...
I thought you were going to say the dark force.
No, I'm going.
That's true, too.
I'm getting there. Between Sanders and Warren, right? Yeah. I think that they put the, you know, the your enemies are my friends and your enemies are my friends, but everybody's enemies with them. So you suddenly they end up in this weird alliance, like, you know, let's try to defend ourselves.
Gotcha.
Get to the next stage and see what happens. So I think that was a very good strategy.
Yeah.
Sanders also, I think he tried not to yell as much as he does.
He tried.
But, you know, he gets some points for that.
Right.
And then, obviously, Marianne Williamson, right?
Light as ever.
Oh, yes. Yeah. But, I mean, it's just, if you measure it with a clap-o-meter, right? I think, you know, she got the night. So every time she said something, boom. But, you know, in all seriousness, I think she has a very, very, very important point, right?
Yeah.
And that point is that people are not talking about those very important issues that she's referring. And sometimes we see it as a joke, but she's really hitting into the core of the problems of the Democratic Party.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, she definitely is like the kind of, I don't know, comic relief. I mean, there's no chance she's going to be president, right? There's no chance she's going to get the nomination. And there's no chance, well, I'll say there's a low chance she's even going to make the next round of debates. But I think she kind of taps a certain energy. And so we make fun of it. I make fun of it. But I think that it sort of suggests a lot of people aren't necessarily looking for the kind of policy details, right, that maybe we assume that they do, right? We're political scientists. We're professors. And we extort our students to pay attention to the issues. But realistically, people aren't doing that right now. So a lot of this is still just kind of jockeying. In fact, like the literature on primary debates suggests that the first debates are the most important. So I think we're almost past that point, right, that solidifies. And the second is that those debates really are only kind of temporarily meaningful. So I don't know that these debates are that helpful. And we've got another, I don't know, 700 hours of these to go. But look, I mean, we watch these debates, 5 hours of debates some random weekend, you know, week during the summer. No one's watching these debates, right? Our friend at UT Tyler, Mark Warren, did some polling that asked Texans if they were watching, and something like 40 to 50% of people watch neither of both debates.
Right.
So I just feel like we're way early. But that said, I mean, there are some movements here that I think are important. And the biggest line and takeaway for me was that it's the revenge of the moderates, right? I mean, if the first round was about the new hope, right?
Like
the new hope for kind of the Democratic Party, this is like the moderate strike back. And I think that many of them scored some points, and they were not people who were household names before, right? Like John Delaney, right? Steve Bullock, who's the governor of Montana.
Right.
They hadn't really been a presence at all, and Bullock wasn't even in the first debate. So the fact that they're now here and saying, what you're saying, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg, is way too liberal for the party and for the country. What do you think about that? I mean, do they have a point?
Well, I think they have a point, but I think that, you know, once again, the problem here is, like, look what happened in 2016, right? You had a candidate that said everything completely out of the, you know, normal campaign book, to-do list or whatnot, and he won.
Right.
So Democrats are doing the exact same thing that they have always done.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, labor, this and that. Yeah. And then they throw very complicated words, very complicated numbers like 30 trillion. What the hell is that?
What is that?
I mean,
no one has a reference for that at all, right?
I don't understand that number, right. I don't even know how many zeros that means, right? I mean, if you put it on my,
it won't fit on your iPhone, right?
Well, I think it will fit on the iPhone if you
I have an old
or
iPhone,
Samsung
so.
Or Samsung.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. No, product placement. Yeah.
Right. If you like flip it horizontally.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
Right. But still, I mean, whatever.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And those are the things that are not communicating to the voters.
Well, and I think you're right. I mean, there's a kind of, it's not identity politics exactly, although that's at play too, but it's kind of an authenticness. And I think that's why people are responding to people like Andrew Yang and Marianne Williamson, who seem genuine. I mean, I don't think either has a chance, you know, at all to be able to get the nomination. But I do think that they tap into a certain, I don't know, sort of sense of where the party should be. And I like your point that the rules are basically changed now, right?
Right.
So it could be anybody, anytime. And
there's no rules.
Yeah.
So the fact that the so-called moderates that was pushed by the moderators, right, of the debate, those are very dangerous waters for the Democratic Party to go into.
Yeah.
And, you know, things like, for example, Andrew Yang, that was yesterday in the second debate, they're very clear.
Yeah.
You're going to get $1,000 a month of dividends.
Right.
End of story.
Yeah.
Period. Who doesn't understand? Oh, $1,000 a month?
Right.
I understand that.
Yeah.
Would you understand Senator Harris, right? Medicare for all, blah, 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 tax this, then I fine, then you do, what?
Yeah. It's Obamacare Plus or it's Medicare for all with private plans. And it's kind of mind numbing, right?
Right.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't care about those things.
Yeah.
I understand $1,000.
Yeah.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
I understand, you know, can I pick my doctor?
Yeah.
Or not?
Yeah. And to me, this is really the scary part for like where the Democrats might go, in that there could be a risk of going too far to the left, right? And I mean, Trump is going to play it up to be a socialist no matter what, right? The Republicans are going to say that the Democrats are whacked out. And Buttigieg actually made this point. He says, no matter what the Democrats do and say, they're going to get this label, so they may as well do what they think is right. That's probably true. I thought actually he was a really articulate messenger for that kind of pragmatic politics. I mean, he's clearly to the left of some of the members.
Right.
I think the average, say, member, not maybe to Bernie or Warren, but, you know, of maybe generally speaking where the things are. I think that was really good. The one thing that was really a problem for Buttigieg was that apparently he had smashed a gnat against his forehead and had a smudge. Did you see any of this?
Oh, no, I didn't. No.
Somebody asked him after the debate about why he had kind of a smudge. It looked like a shadow, but it turns out
really?
That perhaps
he said it was
like a smudge from a gnat that he had swiped away. I thought it was like an analogy for some of the lesser known candidates getting swatted away. I don't know. Maybe
I was listening to the debate because, I mean, the time of the day is extremely complicated, right? So I was cooking dinner.
Yeah. Oh, what'd you make for dinner?
I made butter chicken.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah.
It's a way better use of time than
it's butter chicken, then basmati rice, traditionally cooked.
Hey, good for you.
I'm the guy for those kind of stuff.
But so again, it was a politics roundup and also recipes.
We can do some at the end.
We can do both.
I like to experiment on those things.
Hey, let me ask you about Beto. I thought that his performance was sharper than the prior debate. Obviously, Castro wasn't there to kind of rough him up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The interactions, I thought, were kind of marginalized. He didn't take a lot of barbs, but also didn't come up with many memorable moments. I think this is a real problem for him. I think that he's flatlining and that, you know, the poll numbers are stagnating and even like declining a bit. He's still staffing up and he's still adding policy people and he's still adding comms people. So he thinks he's moving in the right direction, but it seemed to me like he didn't have quite the debate moment that he had or could have had from the kind of tenor of the debate between the liberals and moderates, because he could wedge himself into that and say, look, pragmatically, we can do this and we can do that. Who cares what we call it? He could have had the Buttigieg moment, basically, right? And said, like, I'm the one who can make the parties kind of unified. He's done that to some degree. He talks liberal, governs moderate. That's an Obama-era kind of thing. So what do you think about his performance?
Well, I think in contrast or in comparison with the mayor from the urban city, South Bend, Indiana.
Of course, yes.
As Mayor Pete said. He's doing around 3% on polls on average. Buttigieg is doing around 6%. But I think we had a very interesting moment in terms of when we were talking about identity politics, mm-hmm. right? He said, you know, we have to acknowledge that, you know, this country was built on the backs of basically slaves and people that, you know, were brought to the country forcefully. And then he had a very interesting point in terms of kind of a Cory Booker type of kumbaya, let's get together and work these things out.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree that he performed better in terms of someone told him you have to use pauses and he paused and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, because he speaks in paragraphs when he's kind of on the stump.
But right.
He needed to kind of break it up and make it digestible and frankly make it kind of bullet points because that's the stuff that's going to get clipped and shown.
Well, but I mean, and it's a problem with these debates, right?
Yeah.
First of all, they're not debates.
Right.
Right? Because they start talking, they start fighting and, oh, your time is up. What do you mean?
Right,
I mean,
right.
He's just bringing the knife out.
Yeah, you, right.
Let them fight it.
Let him finish it. Right?
Let him finish and see who wins. You know, type of Lord of the Flies. What is Lord of the Flies?
Lord of the Flies, yeah.
Yeah, something like that, because that's what we need to see. And that's what, you know, on the one hand, it's entertaining, right, for the public.
Yeah.
Right? But at the same time, it's going to be informative.
Yeah.
And right now, these debates are not very informative.
That
right?
first debate was more informative than the second debate, but I take your point. Moderators would, I mean, if this was like a journalist talking to a source, they would never stop them from talking, right?
Right.
They want to kind of get the full story, and we don't have that in these debates. There are just too many people, and it's winnowing, right? The debates that are coming to Houston are going to be, I think, much smaller, which will probably make it more clear. But to me, O'Rourke's strongest play was that he talked about Texas, and that basically implied very strongly that the road to the White House runs through Texas, and he's the one who can put Texas in play. So recent polling suggests that O'Rourke is able to beat Donald Trump in Texas by a lot. I'm not sure I put a lot of stock in that. The poll was an online poll, so there's lots of caveats there. But I think that that was his strongest moment, that if you can talk to people in places where traditionally Democrats aren't winning, then you can do better. And he suggested he's the kind of person who can do that. Steve Bullock made the same kind of point, as did some of the, like, just Jay Inslee and also Michael Bennett, who's in second debate, you know, for senator from Colorado. They're winning blue states. And as a result, maybe they can be sort of pumped up as a nominee, but that's a challenge. But let's talk about night two, because also the gloves were off. The second debate was Joe Biden, along with a bunch of the kind of moderates like John Delaney. You also had Cory Booker and Kamala Harris. What was your take from the second night?
Well, I mean, I think Booker's was very good.
Yeah.
Especially when we talked about criminal justice reform.
Yeah.
He gave it all to Vice President Biden.
Yeah.
In terms of the bills that he sponsored, Tough on Crime, that had put a lot of African American and other minorities like Latinos in prison for very, very small crimes, right? Yeah.
He called it marijuana justice, which sounds like a indie band, you know, winner of the best new band award. But
right.
That's a great point. The criminal justice issue is going to be a problem for Harris, we found out, but also for Joe Biden.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for Harris was very, 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 very tough. You know, putting people in jail for marijuana, this and that, and then laughing because supposedly she smoked marijuana.
Yeah.
So, I mean, those are the things that are going to be important. I mean, she would be tough on crime type of candidate for the general election, but I'm not sure for the primary season he's going to be someone that is going to be, you know, very important or very interesting for, you know, that liberal wing of the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Who are the most enthused individuals of the Democratic Party?
That's a great point, yeah. The other thing I took from it, I totally agree with that, is that, like, the gloves are totally off and that it didn't take long for that to happen. There was a sense maybe early on that the two strongest candidates were Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, but I don't know that after the friction from that night that you're going to see a unity ticket between the two of them. I don't know how many times the word, with all due respect, was used, but that's clearly the new, like, screw you, right?
Oh,
like,
absolutely.
Right?
Oh,
like, that's the new, you know, get away from me. Harris was actually took a fair amount of shots. I mean, the first debate, she was, I think, on the offense, and this debate, she was on the defense, including from Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii, right?
Oh, yeah.
Who pretty much dunked on her on the marijuana issue, and no one else had done that, at least with the kind of, I don't know, sharpness that Gabbard did. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well, that and then doing WWE, what is it, join, or what is it, the one that You hit your point and then he comes
the
in.
The slingshot.
No,
whatever,
not the slingshot. Like when you have like, it's like teams, tag team, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like she team. Was tagging Gillibrand and then Gillibrand tagging her and said like, okay, let's do it, right? Yeah. Going against Biden.
Right.
And I think Biden was better in terms of his response in comparison with the first debate.
Yeah.
Saying, well, different times, different this, different that. And then when he was attacked by Senator Booker, also said, you know, yes, I mean, I have changed. Yes.
Yeah.
End of story.
End of story, yeah.
So I think those are important thing. And it seems that they're desperate, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because so far we have Biden, Booker, Buttigieg, Harris, O'Rourke, Sanders, and Warren qualify for the third debate.
Yeah. And the polling hasn't changed much, right?
I mean,
the fact that we've had now, what, four debates, we haven't seen the polling, snap polling from like the second set of debates, but nothing changed from the first debate, despite the fact that people were sharpening their knives against Joe Biden. So I think that suggests that they are pretty desperate to make sure they can take Biden down a peg. And Biden was ready. I mean, he fumbled a couple of things, which I think was troublesome, especially if
the
you
website.
Think about... I don't know what it was, right? But for those of you who didn't watch, at the end of it, his closing statement, he said something like, you should get in touch with Joe, and then like 330 and a series of threes and O's that
and then
was a P.O. box, maybe? We don't
Buttigieg
know.
The Buttigieg campaign bought that domain, right? In 32 seconds.
Yeah, exactly.
And redirected to their campaign.
Brilliant, brilliant.
Yeah, I
love it. That's a great own for the Buttigieg campaign. I think it was a problem because he seemed to get flustered. He seemed to be confused. There was a point also when he was back with Cory Booker, right, where he referred to him as president. I don't know if he had a kind of Obama flashback or whatever, but he managed to kind of, I don't know, save it in a nice way by saying, you know, future president, you'll be president one day, but I'll be president first.
Right.
So I just thought there was a little bit of a problem there, but he did hit Kamala Harris on her healthcare plan, saying it cost too much and took too long to implement. He did sort of pull himself closer to Obama by saying, we should expand Obamacare. That's the way to win people over. We already have that. And also, frankly, he fended off attacks like from Gillibrand, who said, you know, you've been sort of, you know, an enemy of this and you've been a problem on this since the 1980s. Right. And he brought up the fact that not too long ago that Gillibrand had, you know, tweeted out pictures of her and him, you know, embracing, saying, thank you, Vice President Biden, for helping on, you know, women's issues.
Right.
So he was able to basically play enough defense here to hold the line. But I think it's still the moderate versus conservatives that's going to be the real fight. Once everyone's together and you've got the Bernie and Warren wing, and then you've got the Biden and then all the other kind of moderates, the wing together, I think that's where the real fight's going to come to
I mean, because, you know, in the third debate is going to be all bets are off, right?
Yes, yes.
I mean, you're going to see Sanders going after Warren going after Sanders, everyone going against each other.
Yeah, exactly.
So we'll see. But here, I mean, the DNC has to start getting these people together and say, hey, there's only one of you, right?
Yeah.
That is going to win.
Yeah, and you should be unified. I mean, that's the
point.
At the end of the day, if the unification does not occur, it's going to be bad. It's going to be, as Joe Biden would say, a bunch of malarkey.
And then for the third debate, we haven't talked about Castro.
Yes.
I think Castro, I mean, it's improving every time. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's very articulate. He has ideas. He's punchy. He's sarcastic sometimes.
Yeah.
So
the adios Trump. That was good.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And you know what? That cuts through because you need something that's memorable. And he had that. His problem is that he's not getting the airtime. He had literally half the time Joe Biden had in the debate. If people give him more time, he's, I think, going to be in good shape. But to me, he's setting himself up to be VP. He was measured. He was balanced. He didn't attack anybody.
Right.
I think that is really kind of his kind of design, right? He can position himself for the VP nod he didn't get in 2016.
Right. Well, okay. Maybe that's interesting. And if he gets himself into the third debate, well, I mean, between him and O'Rourke, I mean, we can have some fireworks.
Yeah.
And also, you know, as you said, Gabbard, right, is the next Secretary of Defense if the Democrats win.
Yeah.
I mean, she has no intention on anything like to win the presidency. But,
very unlikely,
you know, she would be a good Secretary of Defense, I think. She has experience.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
I'm all for choosing the best candidate with the best salsa recipe. So, I mean, we have to stay away from these divisive things like putting ranch in your salsa. That's not good.
No, it's not good at all.
And stay away from the dark forces. Hey, Geronimo, I want to thank you for coming and talking through some of these cool issues. A lot going on. This has been Party Politics. It is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media. Big thanks to our producer, Sophie Mall, and a big thanks to our graphics and web team here at Houston Public Media. And of course, thanks to our audio engineer and our nominee for president, Todd Holslander.
I'm Carolino Cortina.
And I'm Brandon Routinghouse. We'll see you next time.